Well, thank you so much for talking to us in the middle of the concert. It was a beautiful, beautiful first half. Romance and serenade. People generally might think Hearts and Flowers. What did romance mean to Beethoven?
Well, I found those romances to be extremely classical in the sense that there is not too much of the typical Beethoven sforzando and real ferocious kind of rhythmic thing. This is pure melody, which makes the pieces in some ways unusual for Beethoven. You know, it's just a very, very beautiful. Both of the romances are extremely melodic, and there is nothing very, shall we say, I don't want to say aggressive, but dramatic. They are not dramatic at all, which I think is very nice, you know, for a change anyway.
Well, you've played them so many times and you've recorded them, and I've heard you talk about how as you play the same pieces, as you get older, you hear different things. Are you exploring anything particular in these?
Well, I just keep hearing. The way I play, I hear myself differently in any case. So it doesn't matter whether I play a Beethoven romance or a Beethoven concerto. It's a different kind of listening that happens to me. And I think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that I've been teaching for such a long time. And I think that teaching is, there's nothing better than teaching for a performing artist. And what I always say to my students when I teach them, and I said, never ever miss an opportunity if you have to teach somebody on any level. Because the minute you teach, you have to really figure out how things work, whether it's technically or musically, and hopefully both. And the minute you figure those things, how they work for other people, you then apply it to your own performance.
I was going to ask you about that because I saw this wonderful video on your website where you talk about music in terms of color and taste and other sorts of sensation.
Well, I think that people should know, musicians should know every aspect of what music feels like and sounds like to other people. So sometimes when you say, can you play it extremely, you know, heavy or extremely light, I find it's easier to say, can you play it like ice cream? Or can you play it like chocolate fudge, and don't make it sound like yogurt. So that means that they have to apply something else than just sound.
When you conduct while you're playing, it must change the experience for you in terms of how you're listening to the music.
Well, conducting while playing is not one of my favorite things, but of course with an orchestra like the Philadelphia Orchestra, and they have a chamber music sense, because a lot of it has to do with orchestra listening to me, because I'm not going to conduct while I'm playing in any case. So they've got to listen to what goes on. And so with this orchestra, it's a lot of fun to do.
And then when you're conducting other repertoire, the first half of this program was very interesting because you were playing the violin and conducting, and then you're conducting Dvorak's Serenade, which is all strings.
Right.
The experience of conducting, on first glance, it might seem as if it's more power.
Well, conducting, let me put it this way. This whole thing about power and conducting, I think, is not correct in my mind, you know. Maybe people get a great thrill of having the power of putting a downbeat and getting this huge sound coming back at you. But I think, for me, I think the orchestra has the power. And if they like a conductor, they have the power to play great. And if they don't like a conductor, they have the power to play okay. And, you know, I mean, there is a subtle difference between okay and great. I'd rather have the great than just the okay. Because, you know, when I talk about it, the level of orchestras is very high in the United States. You know, and, of course, the Philadelphia Orchestra is, you know, one of the great, great orchestras of all time. And they can play anything, they've played anything, you know, they're so good at what they do. But to give that extra, there, I'm sure that they have to have something from the podium that says, okay, we're going to give the extra. We're going to give something, you know, that is the most that we can give. And that's what my hope is, you know, to give the orchestra a reason to make music the way I envision it, the way I hear it in my head. And if I get that, then I'm very, very happy. And I'm getting that, very, very much getting that. So I'm very happy.
And you've mentioned in other interviews that in conducting, you experience a whole different repertoire from what you've been accustomed to. Are you drawn to any particular repertoire?
Well, I'm still doing the, quote, the bread and butter, you know, I mean, the Brahms and the Mozart and the Haydn and Mendelssohn and Tchaikovsky and so on. These pieces are always pieces when you hear, you say, I wish I could conduct them. So now I'm very happy that I'm able to do that. And of course, Beethoven, there is nothing more dramatic rhythmically than a Beethoven symphony. Nothing more than that. I mean, he was the master of drama, the master of intensity, rhythmic drama. And for me, it's so satisfying. So satisfying.
Could you talk a little bit about the shape of this program in particular?
Probably it has to do with classical romantic, you know. So you start with a Beethoven romance, then you get the romantic Dvořák, then you start with a Beethoven classical, and you finish with Brahms. You know, Beethoven was Brahms's god. And it's very interesting to kind of finish with an opening. So which means that, you know, that means that it's not finished. That means that there's hope for the next concert. So we are finishing with the overture. And besides, I just happen very simply to love that overture.
Even though it's called Academic Overture, there's a lightness to it and a humor to it.
Well, there's a lightness to it. And of course, there is the most incredible, inspirational moments of Brahms where we just want to die when you hear the melodic things that it comes in twice in this overture, which always just totally, you know, slays me all the time. It slays me, you know, and I'm always looking forward to that. So this is in some ways is something that's very selfish on my part, that I just love the piece.
One of the things you've talked about in terms of music, in terms of the shape and the color and the personality, is also the importance of humor in music.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and humor has to do not only with the way it's played, but it has to do with build-up of rhythm.
I think it's so great that you talk about humor, because I think sometimes people think classical music is very serious and are somewhat deterred from experiencing it because of that.
That's true. And the thing is that it's not only people who listen to it, but also players. Sometimes players take things very, very seriously in music, and which is, you know, nothing wrong with that. But there's always a lightness in the humor. And, you know, when you conduct a Mozart symphony, or when you play a Mozart concerto, there's an awful lot of humor, an awful lot of lightness. And the thing is that when you play it in a very heavy style, it becomes kind of very, I don't want to say the word boring, but boring, you know. And then, so to make things interesting, you have to figure out rhythmically what happens, and the quality of the sound, the quality of the color of the sound, you know. But that's, you know, that's an interesting challenge.
Another thing you've talked about in terms of music and your teaching is to think about music as talking.
I always say that that's a very good question. I always say to my student that after a while, when you've practiced something, trying to figure out and worry about the playing is no longer necessary. You know, you now worry about the music. So when you worry about the music, you talk about the music. You talk the music. And sometimes I give them a passage from a book or a magazine or anything, and I say to them, recite that passage for me. And let's say that the passage has something, the word, let's say, heroic, or the word very interesting. And I say to them, are you going to say very interesting? Or are you going to say very interesting? You know, are you going to put the emphasis on the word very? Well, it's the same thing with phrasing and with music. You know, you've got to phrase and you've got to figure out what in the music talks to you. Then say it back to the audience.
You play, you conduct, and the story goes you also sing.
I used to sing. I don't sing anymore. I had my farewell debut with two very, very good tenors, Pavarotti and Domingo. And I felt that that was a very nice ending for my very short singing career. So it was, you know, I did the Jailer from Tosca. That was basically my repertoire. That repertoire lasts 19 seconds. So I would say that my career as a singer is probably the smallest in the history of singing. But it was fun while it lasted.
Well, you've had this wonderful, wonderful career, keeps evolving, playing and conducting, and you've embraced popular culture, starting with the Ed Sullivan Show and going on to The Tonight Show, The Colbert Report. You play jazz, you play klezmer. What are your thoughts about the future for classical music? Do you see popular culture embracing it, or some of these barriers coming down?
I think that the future of classical music is good. You're talking to the wrong person. I'm involved in students and in school and in teaching and so on. And from my point of view, it looks good. You know, the level is fantastic. I love, you know, the level of kids. You know, we have the we have a program that we call the Perlman Music Program that's been, the next summer is going to be our 20th summer. And so every summer, you know, we get DVDs of people wanting to come into the program. And so I hear the level of kids, and it's fantastic. So, I mean, you're talking to the wrong person when it comes to doom and gloom. I think that the future is good, and the level is good. So I'm very happy.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us.
My pleasure.